Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, James Jones, and it is September 28th, 2017. And this would be episode 541. I'm waiting for somebody to tell me I'm wrong.
I'm just saying, see, I'm thinking you only said that because Greg sent out that email stating that he was going to be absent for this podcast 541.
What? I'm not looking at my email.
Okay. All right, fair enough. We know the truth, though.
Do we?
This is episode 678. You've been asleep for 3 years.
Good. You know what? I'm okay. I'm okay with that. All right. So I'm joined today by the return of, you know, no, I'm joined by Mr. Guillaume Vaillette.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, Guillaume. We rehired John Lindemann in spite of my better interests and thought processes.
And I was gone so briefly, you never had a chance to even miss me.
I'm not sure that's a correct amount of time that could pass. And we're also joined because Greg couldn't make it this week, so we decided to bring in a first-time guest on the show, Alex from the Say Whatever podcast.
Hi, hello, what's up?
I'll let you get your plug in now. Why don't you go ahead and tell people about your show?
Okay. Say Whatever podcast is something I started with my friends. We just started talking about video games and movies and music that we like, and we ape your show a little bit. I'll admit it.
I mean, it's not like we invented the format. We stole it.
Up with the concept of four guys talking into mics and recording it.
Yeah.
I mean, the format of our show is straight up stolen. Like, it's just rampant theft. So it's fine.
Yeah, but nonetheless, it's a quality podcast, but made by quality people. So
no, that's a little too close.
I like it already.
Also, if I recall correctly, you provided us some music for an E3 show, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that. That was fun music that we used at the E3 2015 set of shows, I think.
Yeah, I was really excited to provide you guys that music, but I was also very disappointed that year in the E3 show. Just the whole... Not you guys, no, just the direct.
Oh, just the E3 in general? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so I was like, hurtful.
Welcome to the podcast. Welcome. Awkward.
It's hard to record the E3 episodes.
But that was the year of Star Fox Zero, so.
Oh, I know. Oh, I know what E3 it was, believe me. At least I didn't go to that one. That would have been a real bummer. But we are here to record a podcast that's not about an E3. Nintendo, for whatever reason, had like 18 games released on Switch in the last week. So that's fun. And we've got a few of them to talk about, but we're going to get to those in a minute. We're going to let Alex kick off the show. So Alex, what have you been playing recently?
Well, I had been playing Phantom Trigger. It came out, I think, in the middle of August on the Switch.
Like August 10th or something like that?
Yeah. And I was really excited to check it out because it looks a lot like another game I liked last year, Hyper Light Drifter.
It sure does.
Yeah, it does.
It looks a whole lot like it. But it's actually got some different mechanics, and there's text, there's dialogue, and Hyper Light Drifter is all very artsy, and there's no, like, there's nothing to guide you. You basically just kind of find your way.
But it's like a big it's an allegory for an illness the developer was experiencing, right?
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
And so Phantom Trigger is really fun from what I've played. At the beginning of the game, Stan, the main character, loses control. And that's kind of like an allegory for how I feel about my life right now.
Wow.
No, immediately after I bought the game and started playing it, I think the very next night, the apartment I was staying in caught on fire. And
oh, jeez.
The whole thing went up. I lost my Switch, and it's very tragic.
That sucks. I'm sorry to hear that.
It's okay. Things are getting better. I have renter's insurance, so you know, I'll be getting a Switch again soon. I'll replace my games, hopefully. I bought everything digitally, so...
So you actually, maybe Nintendo, oh God, this sounds like emails we've gotten in the past. I wish you the best of luck.
But, no, I think the game is good. I'll definitely play it more when I get a chance. I think people should check it out, especially if they've played Hyper Light Drifter, because it gave me all those feels. The music was really good. The graphics are beautiful. Like, it's definitely worth checking out. I think it was only like $15.
Yeah, it's $15. It is published by Tiny Build, and they've made a bunch of different stuff, but I'm trying to think what they would be most remembered for. For me, like my personal game for them is I don't know. I'm trying to think their current one is Hello Neighbor, but they made they published Mr. Shifty, they published Final Station, Punch Club, Party Hard. Like they're one of those, like, I guess they're now becoming more active indie publishers. But I don't know if they make what they make. You know, I don't know if they make that many games themselves at this point.
No, I'm just looking at their Wikipedia article, and they've made No Time to Explain and No Time to Explain Remastered, and they're going to be doing The Hunting Grounds, but that's to be announced.
Ah.
Yeah, that's it. Everything else is publishing.
Yeah, which, you know, they publish some good stuff. So I guess I don't know a whole lot, to be honest, about Phantom Trigger.
Well, it's a slashing game. You know, you just basically you attack and you dash through enemies. You have ranged attacks. You have up close, and you like gain abilities as you go. It gives me a Metroidvania feel, but it's, you know, it's isometric.
Yeah, it's a top-down action game, right?
Yeah. And from what I was getting before I couldn't play it anymore, it seemed like there were a lot of RPG elements. Like, you build up your attacks and maybe can like combine them. There was actually a lot more puzzle solving in it than I thought there would be. It was very simple puzzle solving, though. Like, just drag this green block over to this green fountain, and then something will happen. But I think it's a good game. I haven't heard many people talk about it. I hope that got a fair shake.
But yeah, it. I remember when it was coming out, but I don't remember hearing much about it afterwards.
Yeah. So with my Switch now gone, I'm scraping the bottom of the 3DS barrel, trying to find something I hadn't put too much time into. And after the Direct, most recently, the announcement of Mario Party Top 100 got me in the mood.
The mood for what? To end your life?
To drink? Wow, I was going to go drink. Guillaume, I'm usually the one who goes there.
Well, yeah, it's been a dark time for me, but no, Mario Party Star Rush is actually pretty fun. It's not it's not going to remind you of the original Mario Party games. It's definitely more like the more recent ones. But they have a lot of...
Everybody rides in a car kind of thing?
Well, they didn't do that, actually. They
good.
Yeah, it's more of a mobile game focus, since it is so portable. Most of the minigames are even more simple than you would expect them. Like, sometimes you'll just pull a stylus out and just tap the screen really fast, or alternate between the two bumpers. So there's only like one or two controls per minigame. But what makes it fun for me is the modes. They actually have a mode called Coinathlon, where you are basically, your character on the bottom screen is running around the map, and as you are playing minigames on the top screen, you're collecting coins. The more coins you collect, the more laps you make and the faster you are in the race. And it just bounces between three or four games really fast. It's pretty good.
So have you been playing this with friends or mostly single player?
Oh, only on my own. I don't think I could find anyone that would want to play this with me right now.
That's dark.
But no, it does. It has download play. So
I
guess
that
wouldn't be too hard.
You just have to fool somebody into what they're playing.
No, but I was really getting a hankering for a good Mario Party game. I guess I'm a little upset that the next one isn't on the Switch, but, you know, eventually they'll get there, you know?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. So I've heard a lot of I don't know what the best way of describing my impressions about these, but I've heard some pretty. I mean, I would say negative things, but I mean, it's a Mario Party game. I'm used to that. I've heard some commentary on the mobile Mario games, the portable ones.
Yeah.
How do they sort of engineer this game, the base game, to sort of fit into I'm not sitting in front of a TV, let's not do 50 turns experience?
Well, that is where it is a little weird. There are multiple modes, and it doesn't really guide you into one. You just pick from them. There's like the Coinathlon, and then there's a Toad Scramble, where everyone starts off as Toad. And
truly a nightmare.
Yeah. And no, but all the characters move at the same time. So you're just running around this map trying to like get more coins and stars than everyone else. And then if you bump into each other, a mini game initiates. Or if you have an amiibo, you can tap it and you can be that character if it's a Mario series figure.
Wow. So everyone's a Toad unless they have amiibos?
Well, no, you unlock characters, but the amiibos get you there from the start.
Okay, so that'd be very dark commentary on the state of the Mushroom Kingdom.
But I think it's good. Mario Party, you know, they have always had issues with their format, and I would say less the minigames. You know, a lot of the minigames are decent, if not, you know, a good time.
Yeah, there's definitely a tier list, for lack of a better phrasing, of the Mario Party games, where like there's some that are actually pretty decent, and of course there's the ones that are just like, oh god, it's this one again. I think that kind of makes me a little, I don't know, curious, top 100 curious, all the best, whatever they want to call it.
Well, if they're going to say that they've got 100 of the best levels, the best minigames, they better not have any of the ones that are pure random luck. But I kind of wonder if their selection criteria is even that broad, you know, like no luck-based minigame. It seems like it would be so easy to weed out so many poor games.
Part of what makes me curious about this isn't just that, yeah, some of the minigames are fun and like they're kind of a good time to play. Part of what makes me curious is I want to try to figure out what NDCube thinks are the best Mario Party minigames. Because NDCube's only been making the game since the dissolution of Hudson, but then you realize NDCube is basically staffed with the people who were at Hudson.
Mm-hmm.
So what do they think are the 100 best Mario Party minigames? Like, there's almost like a psychological component of this, of like, I'm going to get inside the head of an NDCube developer and decide, you know, this is the one. The Shy Guy says is the one.
Which is my crowning achievement.
Is the fact that was what they led with was almost kind of shocking. Like, no,
I'm sure
that,
you know, and I can just imagine the heated internal debates that happened. No, I want this one. No. Oh. No, sir.
Oh.
I'm just hoping we have a playable Spike, you know?
Yeah.
You have to only with the Spike amiibo that hasn't been released yet.
One day.
But there is one thing I really wanted you to check out within this game, if you can get your hands on it, James, specifically.
Okay.
It's called Rhythm Recital.
Oh, no. I just pulled up the list of modes, and that one jumped out at me, and I went, oh, no.
Yeah. So
you're not supposed to admit right away that oh no is
yeah.
All right, tell us about Rhythm Recital.
All right, so
sell me on some Rhythm Recital.
You can pick your character, and you have a band of there's three other players, or I guess you can I just do it with the computer. But you play through famous Mario songs, and you have to unlock them as you play more of the actual game, not Rhythm Recital. But
how do you play them?
Okay, so you can tap your stylus to the bottom screen with the same, like as the buttons come down.
Just on the beat.
Yeah, I mean it's more complex, I guess, than just like than what was it, Wii Music? But no, it's definitely the grandchild of it. the music is really weird because the actual tracks are playing, I'm guessing they're MP3s, but the music that your characters are playing are, you know, it's a flute and a violin and a trumpet, and it doesn't sound that great with the songs, because I think they are actually like hitting a fifth above the notes. They're like kind of harmonizing with the rest of the song, and it's definitely different, but I think you'd enjoy it a lot.
Oh, like from a nihilist standpoint, or actually enjoy it?
Yeah, definitely just for the pure pain.
Oh, okay. There is a mini game in the series called Mario Bandstand, where like three characters have an instrument and somebody's conducting. It kind of sounds like that.
Yeah.
Where like you just tap out to the rhythm of your instrument. But that always sounded dreadful. Like just beyond the pale dreadful.
Yeah. There's not really any, as far as I know, besides unlocking more songs, that you don't get anything from playing it, though. You just, you know, you just play the songs.
You get joy.
That's right.
You get to enjoy the game.
But there's no competition, really, between the other players. So I think that's pretty interesting. It was a good choice they made.
I enjoy how James is kind of like Pinhead from Hellraiser. Like, he's the guy that people know to come to him for, because he likes pain.
That's not fair. You know, I...
Reality isn't fair, James.
No, you know, you know? I'm a hard worker. I appreciate...
My work ethic is unparalleled.
I appreciate the complexity and the intricacy in delivering a product, and I understand that sometimes the product will not meet expectations. Right. I can find joy in things that have problems. I'm a positive person to be around. I figured
if
that
you're
was
explaining, little... you're losing, James.
I figured that was a little... But, like you know, maybe I don't know. Maybe this silly symphony is great. Maybe it's musically a disaster. But you know, we can't all be great musicians. So I appreciate the effort that Mario and his colleagues are making. Maybe they should just stick to the different professions.
I guess to end it on a positive note,
I'm trying.
I really hope that when Mario Party finds its way to the Switch, they have a good balance of these easy, quick, mobile type games that you could just pick up really quickly with some friends, and then the regular board game that used to be really great, right? Like, I loved Mario Party 1 through 4, I think. After that, I don't remember what happened, but...
Like, I had fun with the series when I was younger, but mostly, not in the minigames, mostly in just, the game gave you just enough ways to screw with people.
Yeah.
I feel like they could make a Mario Party now that is replete with ways to screw with people. Like, just, you know... Everyone's armed to the teeth in a mutually assured destruction situation where the first one to fire the shot knows what's coming their way immediately afterwards. I kind of liked that. Like, I'm sitting on the opportunity to summon a ghost. The minute I do it, all eyes are on me. There is something about that. There's something disgustingly amusing about the losing is winning mentality that Mario Party sometimes seemed to embody. Like, he's in last place. He's going for sure. I don't know if you watched any of the Giant Bomb Mario Party, I think is what they called the series.
Yes.
But Dan Reichert, who is the monster of all monsters, like he's the person you know who makes every bad life choice and somehow comes out ahead. Somehow convinced his colleagues to play every Mario Party mainline game 50 turns front to back. And it was like you could just see the life exiting their body as the series progressed.
Isn't this the same guy who got married at Taco Bell?
It is the same guy who got married at Taco Bell. Who stuffed the ballot box so he would win getting married at Taco Bell. The point though is that like in the first game, like they just got mad. Like at no point did anybody seem like they were going to die. By the second game, that came around late in the game, but by like the sixth game, the look, the pall of death hung on them as the turn count was being selected. And like that's what I want. Like, I want Mario Party to inspire just like, we're all sitting down to play this. We all know what's going to happen. We're all going to just submit to this, I don't know, experience we're about to have together. And we're all going to like each other a little bit less at the end of it. Like, that's what the series should aspire to. It should just aspire to a degree of fuckery that's not fair or just or in the interest of friend and family.
Fun only in the sense of the misery that you can inflict on other players.
Yeah, like you're commiserating, but you're also, it's also like the Stanford experiment where like you're pressing the button and you're hearing someone scream, but don't worry, they're a bad guy. You should press that button again.
Mm-hmm.
But
they should call it like Mario Freuda.
There you go. But like that's the one thing. Like if it's online, which I feel like it has to be, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's got to be online. How do you know that you've really just speared someone with, you know, right in the heart? And we need voice chat, Nintendo, and I can't be through a phone because it's 50 turns or bust here at Team RFN, so that's like 4 hours, and our phones will all die. Mm-hmm. We need voice chat, and I need to be able to like pick a video camera from somebody right at the right moment. So like we obviously need a camera accessory for the Switch, so I can see John's face when I steal all of his stars, assuming he's wearing clothes, which is probably not a fair assumption.
That's, come on. I mean, I'm a professional to that degree. I keep the clothes on. You know what I'm saying? It's a family show, and also I'm not getting paid. So there you go.
I keep the clothes on at all times, in the shower, at the doctor.
If you want clothes off, we're going to have to negotiate. You know what I'm saying? Money
Mr.
talks.
Lindemann, this exam will go a lot faster if you take your pants off. Oh, my God. All right, let's move on.
Please.
Guillaume.
Yes.
What have you been playing?
So I've been playing, thanks to our friend Soren, who had an extra code for SteamWorld Dig 2.
This is a publisher-provided code.
Yes, but not provided directly from the publisher. Yeah, there was an intermediary, anyway, I still got it for free, which is, I love that. Wow.
By the way, you're welcome. I could have just cashed it in and not told you.
That's true. Thank you, James, I guess. Anyway, people want to hear about SteamWorld Dig 2, I'm sure. And I personally, you know, I was looking forward to it. I know a lot of people were. SteamWorld Heist was in my top five the year it first came out on the 3DS. And it came out towards the end of the year. So it kind of snuck in at the last minute and beat out like so many games that, because, you know, there were so many games coming out on Wii U and 3DS, I'm sure, that year, whatever year that was. So it just like SteamWorld Heist stole my heart. But SteamWorld Dig, the first one, I enjoyed. And that was basically that. Like, I did not have strong feelings about it. Like, after like the 10 hours that it took to finish, I was pretty much done with the concept. And I saw a lot of people kind of, you know, played it multiple times. The game lent itself to that because the levels were procedurally generated. But personally, I was, you know, I played it once, I was done. And SteamWorld Dig 2, unfortunately, like the first hour or so, I played it and it really gave me a strong feeling of deja vu, you know. The game looked better for sure than the 3DS version I had played. It looks also better than the, you know, the HD-fied version that came out later. They've really, like, you know, like, you can see that there's more polish to the art, like, there's more detail to the characters, to the world. It's an all-around, like, you can see they had better, more means to make this game than the first one.
Not more memes, more means.
More means, yes. But, you know, like, the gameplay was exactly the same. And I could not really tell, you know, what exactly made this sequel a sequel. It kind of felt like a rehash to me. And unfortunately, I kind of felt that I still was not ready for more of that, of just SteamWorld Dig. So I was kind of down initially on it, but I knew, like, I saw the reviews, like, I saw that people really loved the sequel, so surely there must have been more to it. And thankfully there is. Eventually, I would recommend people don't stray from the main path too much until you get the grappling hook. The grappling hook is very fun to use, and it does change the way that you play the game significantly. And it kind of unlocks, you know, literally a lot of areas that you can now explore. But it also unlocks kind of fun, quasi, not physics-based, it sends the wrong message, but like it unlocks platforming techniques that you can choose to get into or not. What I mean by that is that, you know, in the first SteamWorld Dig, there was already the wall jumping, right? It worked like in Mega Man X. And if you had a flat wall, you could climb it very easily. And if there was kind of an indentation above you, if there was like one tile overhead that was kind of a roof tile, and then the cliff kept going up after that, you could kind of develop skills enough with the wall climbing to be able to go places that you wouldn't be able to access otherwise, or you would only be able to access them much later with different equipment. So that was something that I liked in the first game, and the grappling hook also unlocks something like that, because it's one of those grappling hooks, like you don't swing from it, you just like you shoot it straight up or straight forward, and it slings you up. Right, it's kind of like Batman's grappling hook. Like so it shoots you forward, and if you're on the, if you tether that close enough to the edge, and if you manage to, you know, press a direction at the right time while you were climbing up, you manage to release it at just the right time, it will shoot you. Like you can make it so that you will shoot past the tile that you were clinging to, and just shoot up further, higher than that, and again, like you unlock all different areas that you couldn't access before. God, I did not mean to make it so technical, but like basically, I really enjoyed the platforming in this game. And you know, once I unlocked the kind of the new mobility options in the game, that's when it really started to prove itself to me. That sounds so
blossom.
To blossom, yes,
there you go.
Like a young engineer,
like a flower. Like a, what? Yeah. wait! Whoa, no! I demand you finish that sentence.
I'm the guy in the booth doing the throat cutting sign.
Rewrap that sentence and finish it, Guillaume.
Anyway, so the platforming
don't
is
you
really
dare
solid.
Edit that out.
And my God. And it just like now it feels good, and I feel like I'm happier playing the game than I was initially. Like as I said, it just felt very samey, and not only that, but it has the whole mechanic of you start out with a lamp and a backpack with limited capacity, and you have to constantly trek back to the surface to sell your goods, to be able to afford upgrades, to be able to store more goods in your backpack, to have a lantern that lasts longer. And that whole gameplay loop at the beginning is just kind of, I felt like it was a little bit too short at the beginning. I felt like I had to trek back to the surface a lot. I found it tedious.
It's that weird, like roguelike, because the game does have some, oh God, I hate using this phrase, roguelike elements.
Sure.
And there's that weird, like, progression cycle of like everything you do sucks at the beginning, and then you can boost your stats to make it better.
Right. But at the point I'm at now, not only have I got the mobility upgrades that make the game fun, but also I've got like a good enough lantern, a good enough backpack, and you can find these hidden cogs that unlock special abilities in your items, and you can assign the cogs to various like effects. And so I assigned some cogs to make it more likely that when I kill an enemy, I'm going to get a refill for my lantern. And that has kind of changed the game enough. Like I keep The Nenturn doesn't go out, so I can last for way longer underground, and it's just less bothersome. And the whole, you know, I understand why they do it. It's kind of like an addictive cycle. You're like, okay, well, one more trek back to the surface, and I can finally afford this thing now. And then, oh, well, I might as well keep playing because it's going to be more fun because I've got an upgrade. And also, it kind of helps pad out the length. So I understand why they did it, but the game only becomes fun when that kind of stops, when it becomes optional. So I wish that they had not done that. But yeah, I really enjoy the game. The game also has kind of the strangely tantalizing kind of mystery to it. Like, there's this whole SteamWorld universe with a lot of mystery about, like, the Steam bots and, you know, who made them. Are humans still around? There's a lot of mysteries, and I'm not sure where SteamWorld League 2 falls into the SteamWorld universe, but it's pretty intriguing so far. The start is basically, it reminded me a lot of Diablo 2, where your new character, Dot, who was an NPC in the first SteamWorld League, goes after Rusty, the main character of the first game, because he's disappeared after, you know, killing the end boss of that first game and becoming, like, super powerful. But turns out that his, like, new abilities were kind of corrosive or were dangerous in some way. And so he's gone, and then you're after him. And apparently there's a whole kind of cult that spawned in his wake. So there's definitely something weird going on there. And I'm looking forward to discovering more. Unfortunately, because these games only come out every couple of years or so, and I don't replay them, nothing about any of the games is fresh in my memory. So there's probably a lot of references that I just
Steam
don't recognize.
World lore.
Yeah, like there's like references that I'm missing, I'm sure. But it's enjoyable.
Good. Cool.
I guess quickly, I've been playing with Lovers in Dangerous Spacetime with Karen on the PC. I was kind of prodded by the fact that the game is coming out next week on Switch, and I had it on my Steam account for like the past year, and I never touched it. So it's this very kind of distinctive looking 2D shooter co-op, and the whole idea is that you're inside this big round spaceship, and it's equipped with, like, you know, guns in the four cardinal directions, and you know, it's got an engine, everything, a shield, and the problem is that everything has to be controlled manually, and you've only got 1 to 4 people manning it. So if you're playing by yourself, thankfully you can enlist the aid of a pet, which you can kind of assign to a various station. And I haven't played that, unfortunately. I haven't had time, but I'm sure they do an adequate job. But playing with Karen, we could not use pets, so we were just 2 people manning this ship, and so you're trying to save these, like, bunnies in space. I don't know. And there are 10 per level, and you need to find 5, and then you can move on to the next one. Or you can try to find all 10, but then you just expose yourself to much greater risk. And anyway, like, so the whole idea is that you're actually controlling these little characters inside the spaceship, and so you have to, you know, kind of platform your way to different stations when needed. Like, you might be, you're always going to have someone who needs to man, to direct, to steer the ship and use the engine. And so you'll try to make your way to some place on the map, and then, oh shit, like, there are enemies coming from up and left. So Karen gets the left gun, and I go to the upper gun, and then we shoot down the enemies, and then, okay, trek back to the engine and go a little bit further, and, like, crap, like, this laser has to be blocked with the shield. So Karen goes to the shield. We carefully make our way past the lasers.
It's an organization game.
It's an organization game. You have to communicate. It's a little bit like Overcooked in that sense, you know.
Yeah,
like
Overcooked, or what was the Wii U game? Affordable Space Adventures.
Right. Yes. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good comparison. I kind of forgot about that game, but yeah. And so it's very challenging, And unfortunately, I kind of feel like when you're only playing with two players, we're kind of a little bit shortchanged because I find myself, you know, like you always need someone steering the ship. So when I'm kind of moving the spaceship around, there's a whole lot that can be happening. And so there's a lot of kind of stop and go. You know, like you move a little bit, oh, surrounded by enemies. I gotta leave my station, go to the gun, shoot them down, go back to the engine, steer a little bit further. So it can take a while to navigate these rather large maps. And it's happened a couple of times when where we saved enough space friends. And then we were like, well, if we go find a little bit more, like we could unlock this this upgrade for the ship. So let's go and try to find more. And then, so we do that, and we end up eating space dust. And it's like we need to start over the whole thing again. And so a whole, like, you know, 20, 25 minutes of progress just gone, and you have to start over. So that's a little bit less pleasant. We've been playing on normal. There's two difficulty levels under that. I get the feeling that I'm going to want to switch down when playing with just one other person. But it's a game, you know, I've got it on Steam, and I'm considering it. I'm considering getting it for the Switch when it comes out, just because I do have two pairs of Joy-Con, and it's going to be much more likely that, it, you know, it's going to be easier to get people, to get two other people to play with us on the Switch than on my laptop. So
yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. A fun game. Like, look at the trailer. It's fun.
It looks like everything's made out of neon, like actual neon lights. Because everything's basically like a hard outline that glows and sort of fills the rest of space.
Yeah.
It's very cute. It's a very cute game.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, like you've got like a frog character and a bunny and these. I don't know. Like, it's very cartoony. It's very.
It's kind of like fat astronaut. Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah. The last game I'm going to talk about is the Super Mario Run update. This just came out today, and it adds a, what are things called? It adds a Star World, which it turns out is 9 levels that you have to complete mini kind of achievements in the main game to unlock. So, for instance, I unlocked one. I had to collect 5 coins or less in the world 1-1 of the main story. And so, yeah, I unlocked only one of the levels, and it's a Star World level, all right. Like, it's still Mario Run, you still move forward, but this stage that I unlocked, yeah, it's a lot trickier, and it's got multiple levels. Like, it feels almost Sonic-like, and there's multiple of those blocks that, you know, if you stand on them and you jump backwards, and you have to use that very judiciously to be able to collect all the pink coins. So I can't even imagine, like, what you're going to need to do to collect the, you know, the other two sets of coins, the black ones and the whatever other color. But yeah, like it's pretty cool. The main other edition is Remix 10.
I was about to ask about this. Yes,
It's basically Toad Rally if you did not like the concept of Toad Rally, of you know, kind of beating random people. And so I guess that they realized that a lot of people just got freaking exhausted just constantly having to rack up toads. So the new mode Rally 10 has you kind of face like a little portion of a Toad Rally. There's no ghost of other players. There's just like 3 kind of special coins that you can collect in random places in that portion of the level. They're over very, very quickly. It's just like maybe like a third or a fourth or a fifth of a complete level. And so, like, you finish one immediately, you start a second segment, you know, a different stage, find the 3 coins, go to the next segment. So, like, doing that, you get these special coins, and when you get enough special coins, you get the possibility of getting kind of a random item for your Mushroom Kingdom. So, it's as if Nintendo realized, like, wait, like, people don't like that working in Toad Rally all that much. What if we transform the whole Toad Rally thing into a gacha? And that's what they did.
Oh, yeah.
There's more to say, but I feel like it's... I think I've bored people enough already.
There's one other thing, though. It's on sale right now if you never felt like buying it.
Right.
Half off.
Right.
So, John.
James. John?
Okay. I was worried for a second.
Never worry. I'm always with you. If I'm not here
now
on this podcast,
I'm very worried.
I'm always in your heart.
I'm exceptionally worried now. Okay.
Oh, boy.
So a fear has crept into my heart. That's great. So, John, we know what you've been playing.
Yes.
Everyone knows what you've been
playing.
Everyone
knows what I've been playing.
We heard you play it.
I mean, I may have been playing it right now.
You
while listening
very,
to Guillaume Wack Poet.
You very bravely did the world's first audio Let's Play. You are a trendsetter.
Well, you
not a good trend, mind you.
As a professional journalist, I like to bring the stories to our people.
No, you're not.
As quickly as possible. You know?
You're none of those things.
I want to be the man on the scene, James, is what I'm saying. And I was for the unlocking of...
For what? The revolution?
Metroid Samus Returns.
Oh.
That's what I was there for, James. And that's what I've been playing.
We were all there with you, John.
And I'm sure that Greg went into things, since he's beaten it twice, apparently. I'm sure he went into vast detail. Which is uncharacteristic for him, because typically he's very sloppy with that kind of stuff.
I think we talked about it for 40 minutes.
We did. By the way, John, in case you're wondering, unlike you, he does listen to the show.
It stings.
Just a warning.
It stings because it's true. Anyways, yeah, so I'm really enjoying Samus Returns so far. I'm not super far into it. The last notable things I did was I got the Varius suit. And the wave beam, so I feel a lot more effective now, especially against the low-level monsters. Just the things I really liked right off the bat is I liked the choice of weapons and stuff that they gave you right off the bat. I like the fact that they gave you stuff like the obviously you get the morph ball very, very early. It's not a big deal, but I like the fact that they give you the spider ball early on, so mm-hmm. you can really crawl around the environments and kind of usually you don't get that. That's something where, you know, going back to Super Metroid, like that's something, that kind of sense of freedom you really don't get, if I remember correctly, until you really get the screw attack and you can actually, you know, I mean, being able to go scale right up to the top of some of the larger environments, some of the bigger, more open rooms, you typically don't get that till quite late. So it gives you a good sense of freedom, and it lets you kind of roam around the environment without really necessarily doing anything too meaningful, but you kind of feel empowered by it pretty early. So that kind of surprised me, but I liked it. I think the game I'm playing it on the OG 3DS. So, and I can't imagine playing this game on, say, like a 2DS XL or something like that, where you don't have that 3D, because the game looks really, really, really good in 3D. The environments are all amazing. I really like what they've done with the sort of Chozo architecture. You know, and sad to say, one of the first things in one of the areas that I went through, where it's kind of like the background is sort of like a giant dam with waterfalls in the background. Mm-hmm. It's a large open room, and my first thought was, man, this would really look good if it was put on a console. So,
oh boy,
yeah. Yeah.
So last week I already cautioned Greg about firing up those Metroid petitions.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe give you the same warning.
Yeah, I mean it's there. It's there. The desire is there. I mean, you know, I think it's part of it is the fact that it's been so long since, you know, I've been so Metroid starved that, you know, and they really, this game really, really looks good. I was honestly skeptical I thought it would be good, but I didn't think it would be this good. Like, to start off with, the way Samus looks at the very start, I thought she looked kind of weird, kind of skinny, right? And I was like, oh, man, I just hope she doesn't kind of look weird like this for the whole game.
She's very tall, John.
Well, yeah, but there's just, like, in the older Metroid games, I mean, she has kind of a certain, almost like mecha-like... sort of like weight to her armor, right? And
yeah, she's a freaking tank.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and she even starts off like that even before she has anything augmented. And it's in this case, she starts off really skinny, but when you start to get the different pieces of armor, then she really starts to look really good and really powerful. So, like I said, I just got the Varia armor, and now she looks really cool. What else do I like? I didn't really know how much I would like the kind of searching function, where you can search the environment for secrets. I actually like that a lot, because it kind of it puts that sort of thing, that sort of exploration, it becomes an ever-present thing. So you're always checking the environment to see, and a lot of
so,
stuff is
sort
obvious.
Of like the scan in Prime.
Yeah. And a lot of
did you liked the scanning in Prime though, didn't you?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you were big into that stuff.
Yeah, I mean in terms of like the lore scanning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I wish they would do more of that. I mean, I wish they would do more of that in some of these if they could incorporate that somehow.
I mean, ultimately, this is sort of the same kind of deal though, isn't it?
To a certain degree, yeah. But this is more functional in the sense that you're trying to find, you know, hidden blocks and places to go. And in a way, it makes that easier. And sort of takes away some of the mystery that has been in past games where, I mean, especially a lot of this, I think back, I compare this a lot to Super Metroid. And in Super Metroid, you had absolutely no indication whatsoever. You literally had to sit there and bomb walls in the hopes it was a complete mystery.
Right.
But, that's how I go through doors.
Yeah,
what are you talking about?
That's how I do. I curl up into a ball and I start dropping bombs. You know, that's how I roll. Pun intended.
Oh. At least bag it, Jesus.
Yeah. I blame you, James. This is all your fault.
Everyone does.
Yep. But yeah, so it takes away some of the mystery, but then again, I think it allows them to get more creative with hidden blocks, and also it allows them, there's all kinds of different hidden blocks that you have to unlock with various things. And so I think because they incorporated it so intrinsically into the way everything is designed, and you can easily find out what the hidden blocks are, that allowed them to kind of get more creative with the types of puzzle-based access to certain areas. Like you'll find a block and you don't even know what it's for. Like it's a certain color and you don't know because you don't have that weapon yet or something like that. But it'll be there. So they're still doing that. They're still kind of foreshadowing, but it's more overt. So. But yeah, I think the visually the game is really striking. I think the music is really, really good. And I think Mercury's theme, I think they just did a great job. I'm incredibly impressed by it. More impressed than I thought I would be. I mean, I think they really nailed it. I was kind of worried that it would come off as kind of an off-brand Metroid, but it feels really authentic. You know, the way that Samus moves, it has the same kind of responsiveness that I was looking for. So you can tell that, you know, that Nintendo really probably was very exacting on exactly how they wanted this game to play. But Mercury Steam, to their credit, they executed it flawlessly.
I mean, I wonder, people were concerned, you know, because of course the Castlevania games they made had their detractors, especially the 2D one, Lords of Shadow, Mirror of Fate. But, you know, I wonder if, of course, Castlevania and Metroid are inextricably linked at this point. I just wonder if, you know, they made the game Konami wanted them to make. And in this case, they made the game Nintendo wanted them to make. And one of those companies doesn't make video games anymore.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Like, you never know.
Iga was already out the door, right?
Yeah. I mean, so here, to give you an idea of when, not to take us too far aside, but I was in the E3 event where they talked about, the Lords of Shadow games, which of course this is in that same transmedia multi-game experience, and basically they had like Kojima kind of tease it, like who has fuck all to do with that series. So yeah, like it could just be a situation of like maybe we just didn't give them enough credit.
Yeah because but, I mean technically they absolutely have the chops to do this,
obviously. They've delivered.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's the real deal. I mean, if you're on the fence about whether or not this feels like a real Metroid game, it feels like a real Metroid game. Like, it definitely does.
Cool. I'm glad to hear that. You know, it's not my series, obviously. Not my Metroid or whatever.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm glad for the people who have just been dying I mean, whom have acted as if they were living without kidneys because of the lack of an official 2D Metroid.
Yeah, and what impresses me too is that the bosses are actually fairly challenging. Because you start off, you have the parry attack, which is actually takes a while. I actually had to get good at it. I was kind of, I was sort of, you know, bitching and moaning at the start, like, oh man, the parrying sucks. And, you know, and that's why at the very start, if you would have asked me, I'm like, ah, you know, the game looks good. And, you know, it feels like, you know, like a real Metroid game and everything, but just the parrying, it's just so difficult. It's so cheap, but you actually do have to really get the timing down for all of these different enemies. And especially the bosses, because the bosses, they're unforgiving. And I had actually read that in a review where they said, you know, for the bosses, you have to learn the patterns of the bosses or else you're just not going to get anywhere. And that's all there is to it. There's no way to cheese them or anything like that. And so there was a boss early, one of the early Metroids in the game. I couldn't beat him for the life of me. And I thought, well, you know, in past Metroids, I've said, oh, okay, well, obviously there must be something missing because usually you get the right item. You know, maybe it's like a certain kind of super missile or something, and then you come back and you just wipe the floor with the boss. And the reason why you're getting your butt kicked is because you don't have the right stuff. But in this one, no, there was none of that. It was, you have to learn the pattern of the boss, and you have to get better and beat the boss and figure out how to beat the boss. And I like that because it's very kind of old school design. It's not bad design. It's just, this is the way this boss operates.
Figure it out.
You have to figure it out. We're not going to tell you how to do it. We're not going to handhold you. We're not going to give you some super gun or something that you can just, you know, use some sort of Rochambeau kind of thing on it to destroy the boss. No, you have to figure it out. Just get better. And I did. And eventually I beat the boss and it felt really good. So it was really cool.
Nice.
And they also checkpoint you right before the boss. So
yes.
There's no, you know, trekking back to the boss after it wiped I don't know how that expression goes anymore.
Yeah.
Wipes your ass on the floor?
No. What? No.
Wipes.
He's not a dog.
Wipes the floor with you?
Yes.
Wipes the floor with you. What? Kicks your ass, hands it to you.
Yeah,
okay.
You combined a couple different idioms there, and basically described the dog.
Sorry for the mixed metaphors.
Young and nubile. You know how it goes.
What? No.
Yeah. So that's what I like too. Exactly. That Guillaume brings up a great point.
That's what he likes too. Young and nubile. Thank you, John.
They kind of made that exception, which I thought was an interesting choice because, of course, other Metroid games, they will start you back at the last place that you saved. Now, granted, most of the save points are near the boss, anyways. However, this Samus Returns, it starts you right outside the room, which is actually nice because what you can do is even though you're dying over and over again, you can usually kill nearby enemies. And, you know, if you happen to have started the boss attempt with, say, low missiles or low health, you can sort of farm. You'll die, but you'll restart with the same energy and missiles that you had before you went into the room.
Right.
And while you're right outside, you can farm a little bit. So over time,
it's basically
you actually
a safe state.
Yeah. Yep, and you can get into better, a save state, but also that gives you the opportunity to farm a little bit and actually put yourself in a better, state to beat the boss than you were before.
Yeah,
so
cool.
It's not punishing. So they set it up so the bosses are challenging, but they kind of set you up to succeed if you're good enough to actually beat the boss. So
cool.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. It's a really good game.
Excellent. So I'm going to wrap us up today. I'm going to move a little brisk because I've only played the game for an hour, and all of my time playing it is captured on video. twitch.tv/NWR_James. I got today's new release Golf Story for the Switch, as I alluded to at the beginning of the show. 16 games came out this week on Switch, which is obscene. I mean, it's not obscene. Like, that's what a healthy platform does. But, like, with the Switch's eShop and, like, how stuff displays on there and with just, like, the fact that multiple games here are good and the noise, like, how the hell are we supposed to figure out what to cover? So, I needed a game to play, and so I got Golf Story. So, if you remember back to our retro... Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, so people, you know, like, clearly the game is inspired by Camelot's Mario Golf. You know, GBA.
The GBA specifically.
Game Boy games, right? So how close is it to that? Like, have you had a lot of dialogue scenes where you can choose yes or no, and ultimately that, you know, those choices don't matter at all?
No. So I've had a decent number of dialogue scenes. So it's here's the thing. This feel, and again, I've only played it for an hour, but what's the Harvest Moon? I don't want to use the word knockoff, but you know what I mean.
Stardew Valley.
Yeah. Where Stardew Valley came in and basically said, like, this template of Harvest Moon, they've made a lot of these. We're going to make one of these and then make it do more. But, like, the DNA is so clearly just ripped clean from, you know, just like, this is coming with us now. that's here in play as well. But it takes a slightly more, I would say it takes a very different tone. So if you go back to the retroactive that we did for Mario Tennis for the Game Boy Advance, 10 out of 10, perfect game, Stan Ferguson, NintendoWorldReport.com. Was that Stan? That was Stan, right?
Doesn't really matter. He deserves it.
No, it doesn't. I actually was like kind of surprised how much I enjoyed that game and its rhythm and the dumb bullshit RPG stuff and all of it. Like I kind of really enjoyed that game. And but what was fun about that game was the whole progression and, you know, being able to just challenge people and making your way up. And there was something about just when you get to the late stage and you're trying to climb the ladder, like just beating the number one ranked person and just the sense of just, I did it, man. Got it. They have all that here. They have the RPG mechanics. They have the getting better, climbing the ladder stuff going on. Although I haven't gotten to that part just yet. I've gotten to the RPG mechanics. And, you know, you're challenging other golfers that are around. But this game takes a very different tone. Irreverent to a degree. A little bit sinister sometimes. You know, a bit weird. Deliberately weird. So to give you an example, I'm wandering around the golf course you start with, and I think it's called like Ragged or something, like Ragged Golf or something like that. Like the course itself is just completely beaten to crap. You know, there's just loose dirt around. There's kind of trash. The course isn't being well maintained. It's just not good. You meet the person who owns it, and he seems unsavory and money grubbing in the extreme and willing to scam you out of your money no matter what it takes. The coach is just not interested in taking on new students. But unlike Mario Tennis or Mario Golf, where you're a bright-eyed youngster, this game starts you as a bright-eyed youngster and then fast-forwards 20 years in time with you waking up in bed answering a phone call from whom I'm assuming is your girlfriend, excoriating you for not getting the boxes out of her house. So I say maybe ex-girlfriend. And your character sheepishly reveals where he is he's back at the golf course trying to get good at golf again. Obviously very embarrassed by what he is doing. And essentially, like, it's just trying to string together, you know, victories in these really strange challenges. So, for example, one character you're on the driving range and you're told to, like, put the ball on certain spots in the driving range and you have to make it land in a certain number of rings before the end of like 8 swings. You have to get it in 6 rings, and some rings overlap and stuff, but some of the rings have a gopher in them, and if you land in there, the gopher just picks up your ball and takes it somewhere else, which is really kind of a bummer. But you know, I probably lost a couple swings, so I'm gonna hit that fucking gopher. Never did, but you know, I tried. One of the challenges, there's a woman who is yelling at her son to get out of the water because he's gone into the lake at the golf course and is in like an inner tube just sort of floating in the middle. He's supposed to be like a small kid. And your character says something like, we need to get him out of there or he's going to get eaten by the alligators. Your character goes, there's no alligators in here. And then all of a sudden an alligator pops up and shoots out of the water, which everyone appropriately reacts to. And the way you get him out of the water is, of course, you hit him with a golf ball. Because unlike Mario Golf, you could just drop a golf ball at any place in this world and take a shot. And hit people, hit things, hit buttons that are hidden in the stage, hit a small child floating in a lake and cause him to start talking like Steve Irwin. And the propeller beanie he's wearing to start working and he flies back to shore. at which point his mother asks, what did you do to him? And you respond simply, he's fine. And then you go about your business. There's a extended sequence where the coach decides he's not going to train you, so you decide you're going to beat all of his dysfunctional students, which I sort of overdubbed into, I'm going to beat these children. But in reality, that's pretty much what he's saying. And you challenge three children to golf and you humiliate them. So like there's a weird sort of edge to this game's humor. And it's much more about exploring the weirdness of the world you're in. And there's a very surreal kind of perspective into the game world that that's going on here. So it's not quite as like upbeat and cartoony as Mario, obviously. I assume all the ladder stuff, all the getting good and challenging is coming. I've only played a couple rounds of golf so far. And I know that I've got a big round coming up next, like right where I stopped. So that's probably where the game opens up and I get to actually experience more of the golf. Your goal is obviously to become a professional, and I am looking forward to that. But to give you an idea of what this game is all about, really, when I woke up, I went to my giant CRT TV and started it up. And first it was an infomercial for a blanket that has a reversible image on the other side. Then it was, I can't remember what the next ad was. And then finally it was back to Golf TV, which was the channel, where they were interviewing the number 8 ranked player in the world. He's like, so how did you do today? Well, my putt was really good, and I knew I had my putt game going, so I felt pretty good about my chances. And then the next question was, you know, during the 8th hole, we saw you yell at your caddy for 5 straight minutes. What were you saying to him? Well, my putting game was really good. I knew we had a good chance. I was like, wait, what? That was a great interview. Very insightful. Thank you. And I was like, well, this game is weird. And it is. It's got a very kind of nice sense of humor that I'm enjoying, and it plays really well, and the golf feels good. It's got more stuff to it than a lot of these Camelot games had, more technique. I like the leveling up system. You get, I think it's 6 points every level up, and you get experience for the challenges. And you can put a point in power so you can drive further, but that knocks all your other stats that deal with like control and spin and finesse and the cleanness of your shot. It knocks them down. So you level up power, then you need to go level those up, put them back towards 0.
That's how Mario Golf also worked, right?
I believe it was, yeah. Yeah. So like you can just keep like playing your stats up, and it's working out really nice. And I like what I'm doing. I like playing it, and I'm having a good time. So, like I said, I've only played an hour, so I'm not going to talk a whole lot about it because I suspect I'm going to have some pretty deep impressions next week. But on that, it is time to wrap up new business. Please stick around because when we're back, it'll be time for listener mail. We're back. Listener mail. You can send us your emails to RFN at Nintendo World Report in a manner not unlike the one that has been done by these fine people. Alex, would you care to read the first email?
Sure. Derek from Toronto writes, hello, gents. With the sudden influx of roguelike games on Switch, Goner, Binding of Isaac, Tumbleseed, Kamiko, Has-Been Heroes, so far I'm really enjoying Goner and Tumbleseed. Both are very difficult and addictive. What are your opinions on these games and the genre as a whole? Do you have any suggestions for other roguelike games that you've enjoyed in the past? Thanks, and keep up the great work.
Guillaume, do you think we should read the other one right now, or would you like us?
Oh, sure. Yeah, because we received these very close to each other and from the same country.
Yes.
So,
and you know there's only like 4 people in Canada, so that's
it's true.
Like, yeah. 50% yeah, of the country. Weird. I mean, yeah, it's...
Yeah. Well, 50% of the country are on this show then, so then the other ones wrote...
Yep, it's a cabal. Uh-huh. Yep.
So God then, damn it.
A cabal then of roguelike fans.
Dan from Canada writes, I find myself being immediately turned off a game when I hear the term roguelike associated with the description, which is often lately with so many coming to the Switch eShop. Basically, I have the exact opposite reaction from when I hear the term Metroidvania in the description. Despite some roguelikes having interesting art styles or music or gameplay mechanics, I hear the term roguelike and immediately associate that game with no end goal, repetitive gameplay, and or that I'm just aiming for a high score or fastest speedrun. Does anyone else feel this way? Am I missing out on some great game experiences because of this assumption? Any games you can recommend that may change my opinion? Love
you
to
know,
hear your thoughts.
You know, these two started in very different places, but they ended up together looking for suggestions.
Yeah.
There's something calming about that.
You know, I don't know. I sort of feel the same way. I kind of have the reaction to roguelikes where I kind of automatically I'm like, I don't have anything negative towards them, but I'm kind of like, it's not my thing.
You know? It's
and
funny
I,
because
I, since I say that I have played Binding of Isaac, and that's a good game. It's just really not, I'm not really that into it.
You know, you know when you say a word a bunch of times and it loses all meaning? You just say it over and over and over and over again, and you just kind of like, it just starts to sound like noises and not actually a word anymore. Roguelikes have kind of gotten to that point. And it's not to say that there aren't things like roguelike. It's just like the title gets applied so broadly that, you know, you could say that, I've seen people say that Faster Than Light is a roguelike. And I would argue, not really. Mm-hmm. To some degree, yeah. Like you can buy stuff with what you get, and it unlocks, so you can use it in future attempts, like new ships and stuff. So yeah, in a way, it is a roguelike. Binding of Isaac has roguelike elements. Risk of Rain, Spelunky, those are all very different games.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, first I wanted to read these emails because, Dan's email especially, because he mentions that to him it evokes, like, no end goal, and that, I don't think that's actually a feature of roguelikes, but
it's a feature of some, but not all.
Right, but a game like Spelunky, which was kind of on the forefront of this kind of a rogue renaissance or whatever, like...
Rogue-a-sauce?
Fuck you. So you know, like it does have an ending, as far as I can tell. I've never seen it, but you go through various, you know, you go through levels, you go through various environments, and there's you unlock shortcuts, and eventually you can make it to the ending. But like, okay, so the roguelike comes from a game I haven't played called. I
Rogue.
Call it Rogue. And yes. What were its determining features? That the enemies would only move when you move? That the levels were procedurally generated?
I mean, keep in mind, Rogue came out in 1980. It is a very, very old game.
Right. Like, you were basically playing as the smiley face from QBasic or something?
Pretty much.
Right. Or in the at sign. Anyway... there were various kind of the items that you could pick up in this dungeon that you would be exploring would have random effects, and you would only learn what they do when you actually use them. So, you know, you might try to make it through a level, you're down and, you know, you've got literally no other recourse than to drink the mystery potion that you got.
Right.
So you try it and you cross your fingers that it has a positive effect and it's not poison.
So really it was kind of a combination of the text-based adventure games that had been around for a little while at that point. Things like Zork, but with procedural generation attached to them. So with a lot of those games, you could basically just say, like, I know what the route is. I've learned it. You know, I type look, wall, press, door. You know, and eventually you can just sort of get to the point where you just know the route through. Whereas this said, okay, I want to take that kind of game and then basically add, for lack of a better word, randomness to it to keep it interesting.
Yeah, and a certain level of combat.
Yeah. But one of the things that Rogue introduces are things like, well, not introduces, but one of its defining features are things like the permadeath. And, you know, there's a few other elements that ultimately bled through into the roguelike genre. But what that means and what that is inherited by individual games, like ultimately what elements of that become, define the term roguelike. It's not necessarily like super clear, like, oh, these are the elements that mean roguelike.
It's probably like RPGs. Some games, many games have RPG elements now.
Right.
But they're not RPGs.
To the point where we invented the phrase RPG elements.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. The press for Phantom Trigger, it actually even says merging elements with slashers, RPGs, and roguelike genres. But I don't really see much of the resemblance because there's pretty often there's a checkpoint, and when you die, you still have all the same stuff you had. I don't.
Right. I mean, that sounds like some SEO nonsense.
Yeah.
But, right. So one of the more pure roguelikes that you could play on Nintendo systems is Shiren the Wanderer, which we've talked about on this podcast. And it does have kind of the, you know, overhead perspective. You're going through these mazes and you're trying to, you know, go to the next level, and you find these items that you don't necessarily know what they do. These scrolls that have like various spells, and these spells are kind of you don't know what you're getting when you get the scroll. That game had multiple, like, it's very punishing, it's very tough to get through, but it did have some permanent features that you could unlock. Like, if you made it to a certain point, like you could keep one of the, like, your best weapons for the next playthrough,
right?
Or you could kind of unlock features in the starting town, and that would still be there on your next playthrough. So little by little, you would unlock things, and you know, you would get help to make it to the end. And yeah, there's been games like Chocobo's Dungeon Tales.
Yeah, the Mystery Dungeon games are there was sort of a run of that stuff continuing sort of in Japan. You know, Chunsoft made the Mystery Dungeon games. There was a Torneko game, I believe, that was a dungeon, like a Dragon Quest side game.
Torneko,
that was,
yeah, is the shopkeeper from Dragon Quest IV, right?
Yeah, Torneko's Great Adventure or something like that. That's kind of roguelike-y. But yeah, there was the Chocobo one that said for Final Fantasy, which is a Mystery Dungeon game, and the Pokemon ones. But really, you started seeing, these elements come into the Western games, I guess, in the early 2000s. Obviously, like, things like Diablo had elements of it in there.
Right. But, yeah, that's what the term has come to kind of mean recently. I feel like if you get your game has procedurally generated anything, that's kind of what it means right now. Like, some people will call them roguelites, games where, you know, there's not so much punishment when you die.
Right.
And but you do have kind of little features here and there from the roguelike. And that's the thing that I want to drive home, like, to Dan, is that the, you know, all those games that are more kind of closer to rogue have endings, all those games that we mentioned. And most games, I think, that have roguelike elements also have endings. They just end up lending themselves well to score attacks or time attacks because of the procedurally generated levels. I don't know. Like, I think it kind of appeals to people who like to perfect their mastery of the controls. You know, it's not so much learning about a level anymore. It's about being able to respond to the situation correctly and being able to quickly overcome whatever obstacle the game throws at you.
Yeah, I mean, it becomes a familiarity with not just the game, but its systems and, like, what you need to do to deal with a certain situation. So, like, Don't Starve, for example, has roguelike elements. But you get better at surviving in that game. And it arguably, like, this filters into survival games as a general, like that whole genre that's really started to explode on the PC space. Not necessarily that they're roguelikes, but that it's sort of the same kind of mentality. Your first playthrough, you're not going to do well because you don't know the game systems. Like, no matter how good you are at video games, no matter how good you are at that genre of video games, you're not going to know the specifics of that game. And as a consequence, you are going to die. And that learning those systems ultimately allows you to advance and get better at it. And through repetition, you're going to see a lot of the same stuff because you're going to die a lot in the beginning. and you're going to end up seeing, even if it's randomly generated, they're usually, you know, there's a progression to the games. But, you know, obviously Faster Than Light has an ending. Like, that's the whole point of the game. You are trying to get to a place. But you will not get there your first playthrough. You probably won't get there your 10th playthrough. It's going to take a while. But, I mean, to give you the idea of what the Wikipedia definition of a roguelike is, and to tell you, and to get to the point of how much of this stuff is all just subjective.
The Webster Merriam Dictionary describes the roguelike as the...
I'm actually doing this to make a point. So if you'd shut your damn mouth for a minute, they say that it requires it being a dungeon crawler. It's procedurally generated levels with turn-based gameplay and tile-based graphics and permanent death of the player character. But we've named a bunch of games that don't have any of those things that still wear the roguelike badge. Like the word itself shouldn't either excite or turn you off. You really need to understand how it's manifested in the game.
Right. Yeah.
Getting to the games that work well, Rogue Legacy in a way is kind of more pure in what it's trying to do. Like, you die, you progress some but not all of your skills back down a generation, and you generate a new player character that in theory inherits, you know, based on the money that you were able to accrue in the castle, a better starting position to restart the game.
Right, Rogue Legacy is the kind of the Castlevania-like 2D platformer roguelike, right?
Yeah, so essentially you're a knight who goes into a castle, and you pick from a set of knights who have different attributes, and they explore the castle, and they collect money, and then when they invariably die, they get to keep that money, but only as much as they can spend before the next generation starts. So you can buy all kinds of upgrades that either make it possible to earn more money or to increase the performance or get better weapons. And some of those things carry over, or they're permanent. So like the fact that more expensive items show up in the stage, that stronger enemies that drop better money show up in there, stuff like that. Some of them are like temporary buffs, like the next generation will have more health, the next generation gets a better weapon, stuff like that. And essentially what you're really trying to do in that game is A, get good at playing it, B, make the starting position advantageous enough that you have a character that can make it through the whole dungeon, and C, that the characters who have died have mapped enough of the dungeon that you're in a position that you can kind of continue on, because you can actually spend money to keep the same map you had last time. So it's not just about getting good at the gameplay. It's about sort of building towards what is, you know, this is the run. You really plan for it. Like, you in that game, when you're gonna make the final assault, you know, you may burn through a couple generations, like, okay, this isn't the one. I just need to earn enough money so that I can see if it's the next one. And like, you're looking for that character that has the skill that will let you pull it off, and then you go for it. And it can be kind of repetitive, because you're replaying parts of the same dungeon, even if it's been regenerated. It's the same sort of, it still has the same sections. But it presents a unique challenge too, because there's this like planning metagame going on that you're executing. And I mentioned it a couple times, Faster Than Light's great. It's very simple, but there's no dungeons. It's not, there's no like sprite based graphics. It's not really turn based. But yeah, like you carry elements through.
Yeah. The one that I've played probably the most is Spelunky, and I'm very not good at it, but it's just a well-made game that has a lot of surprises to it, you know, like the various elements that make up the levels will interact in surprising ways sometimes, at least the first time that you see them interact together, you know. Like when you see like the shopkeeper going after like I don't know, like having reactions that you never saw before. Like, it's surprising, it's fun, and also it kills you usually. But then you learn from that, and you take that with you on your next playthrough. So that's one fun aspect of roguelikes. It's like learning the systems, and that's what makes... that's the way that you level up, basically.
That's the appeal. Yeah. That's the progression model.
Yeah. So hopefully at some point that comes to the Switch. Other than that, like I've got on my backlog, I've got Has-Been Heroes that I'm supposed to play at some point pretty soon. Someone lent it to me. I also bought a while ago the Etrian Mystery Dungeon game that came out. So will I get to that before Etrian Odyssey 5 comes out? I don't know. But
I mean, SteamWorld Dig has some roguish elements to it too, doesn't it?
Right. The first one has procedurally generated levels.
You get money and you spend them for upgrades and you die and you start back over. Right? You have permanent upgrades. But you lose your progress, don't you?
No, you don't.
Oh, that's right. There's checkpoints.
Right. The levels are procedurally generated from one, you know, game to the next, like one complete playthrough. Yeah, it's once the levels are generated, they're set.
Right. What about you, Alex? Do you have any roguelikes that you would recommend for somebody who is potentially turned off by the genre or wants to kind of get a broader understanding of its appeal?
I honestly haven't played too many of them myself, but what gets me interested in them is just the appeal I think Dan was saying, that trying to beat your score and trying to just get, you know, like a shmup, just trying to get better and better as you play. That's where I have most of my experience. I play a lot of Star Fox 64, and I just always try and get better and better every single time, get a higher score. And then same with Graceful Explosion Machine on the Switch. I was getting really into that. But yeah, as far as roguelikes, I haven't dipped my toe into that too much.
That's fair. What about you, John?
Really the only real modern one that I have any experience with is Binding of Isaac. And I mean, it's good. It's good.
I've got a friend who must have logged in 400 hours into it.
That is, oh my God.
That's crazy. Yeah, I mean, it's a really good game, but it's not really my genre.
But yeah, how Binding of Isaac expresses its rogueness is you essentially get things that you can buy permanent, lasting upgrades that make your position better. Mm-hmm. But you're still replaying the game from the start.
Correct, yep.
Every time. So yeah, it's still like a grind and get better and unlock more stuff that gives you more advantages. I think in Binding of Isaac, I'm trying to remember because it's been a while, I want to say what you actually buy is you buy the possibility that certain power-ups will appear in the game. You just keep dumping money in to make the power-up pool more and more advantageous. Because Binding of Isaac, of course, has power-ups and power-downs, things you get that are actually, you know, disadvantageous.
Yeah.
But they don't tell you what they do either until you pick them up, which is always kind of makes them a little scary. But by controlling what shows up in the mix, obviously you can sort of stage the game to your advantage and potentially give yourself a boost that'll get you over the hump in that game. Bad choice of words for that game. All right, well, John, would you read the next email?
I certainly will. TJ McCart writes, "Hello, RFN. I just wanted to get your opinion on how Nintendo's stock has risen specifically from the Chinese markets over the announcement of Arena of Valor. Since y'all were kind enough to address the topic of a MOBA on Switch before, I thought this would be good to dive deeper into, since no one seems to be talking about what could be the biggest announcement from the recent Nintendo Direct. With all the great games coming to the system, I feel a free-to-play game like this holds a lot more appeal than folks realize. The challenge won't be getting people on board with the Switch until the end of this year. It's going to be getting them to stick with it. Looking forward to hearing your opinions on this, rather than James's Ogre Battle obsession, even though I completely agree."
I don't think I've mentioned Ogre Battle like anything besides an opaque reference in a while.
Well, you see, James, that's the thing. It's really the zeal with which you go into Ogre Battle games when you do talk about them.
That's true. I think the last time we talked about them was the fact that I couldn't find that cool-looking Neo Geo Pocket Color when I was in Japan.
Yeah, but what sticks in my mind is
the cool-looking box of a Neo Geo Pocket Color. It's the bone-standard Neo Geo Pocket Color inside.
I was there, James. I was there. I was experiencing
anyway,
that with you.
I've just had to scratch off the... it's been 15 episodes since James talked about Ogre Battle.
Does it count if you're baited into it?
Yeah, it's like...
Anyway...
It's like, you know, in a factory, they have the sign, you know, this many days. since the last
I'm glad you took any opaqueness out of that reference, John. Thank you. Yep. All right, so
that's what I do.
Arena of Valor. We talked about it. We had the original question was, hey, could a Switch support MOBAs? And then we all looked around and we're like, who knows what MOBAs are?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Tencent first. I mean, Tencent is a company that is not really that well known in North America.
Well, not. Yeah. Yes. Important distinction.
I would say. Yeah. An important distinction. They are. I believe they are technically the world's largest game company.
I believe that is correct. Yes.
They are absolutely massive. So if you haven't heard of them, you play a game. Chances are you play a game by a company that they own or have invested in.
Tencent Holdings Limited is the proper legal name for that company.
Yeah. I mean,
Limited is ironic.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because they're so big.
Yeah. I mean, they own Supercell outright.
Right. John, what does Supercell make?
Oh, God, I can't even think of it.
Clash of Clans?
Yes, Clash of Clans.
Yes,
and they make a ton of money. I mean, Tencent last year, they recently surpassed Wells Fargo to become the 10th biggest company in the world by market cap.
Which is absurd.
Yeah, their revenues are $10.2 billion, and that does not include what is made by Supercell, which is also, they make billions.
Yes.
They have invested in Epic Games, Activision Blizzard, CJ Games, Glue, Plain Vanilla, Aiming, Pocket Gems, and they have an 84% stake in Supercell and full ownership of Riot, who makes League of Legends.
Which is a ton of money making itself.
Yeah, which if you look on Steam, it is the most popular game or the second most popular game forever.
Well, and they are apparently looking to invest in the company that makes Player Unknown Battlegrounds, which is also making a shit ton of money.
Yes.
Because they've reached the phase of a company where, like, something pops up, just fucking buy it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they...
I mean, that's how they ended up with Riot. They're like, this thing is making money, just buy it.
Yeah. Yep. So they are a Goliath. They're not even beyond the scale of huge companies like Activision, huge companies like EA. They are gargantuan. So if you haven't heard of them, you're either playing a game.
And they're not just a games company either. Like they own chat software that serves China.
Yep.
They own a payment processing company, you know, your PayPal equivalent for China. They own a movie production company. They own like a web browser production. Like they're in everything.
Yeah, they have the top Android store in China, and WeChat, which is their chat, their chat client that you were talking about. They have 889 million active users.
Right, because remember, when you're dealing with China, they kind of are just big, and like if you can get percentage penetration in there, it's a lot of people.
Yeah, so their big MOBA is over. I believe in China it's called Honor of Kings. Over here, it's being rebranded as Arena of Valor. And it is huge in China. It's 5-on-5 MOBA. Already millions of downloads on smartphones. And so it'll be interesting to see how this does free to play. Interesting to see how this does on Switch. I think it will play really well on Switch. I think. And it's interesting because I'm not a big fan of this genre necessarily. It's just really not my thing. I'm not a big fan of StarCraft either, but I think that it's interesting because I think this game has a better chance of doing well on Switch than it does anywhere else, just because of the audience that is coming to the Switch. You're getting a lot of people that are just, it has a lot of buzz around it, obviously, and there's a lot of people that I work with that are like, hey, I'm gonna get a Switch, and I'm like, wow, I never thought you would ever be interested in getting a console like that. And they're like, nah, it looks cool. You know, it's like, it's neat. It's portable and this, that, and the other. Much more buzz around. I mean, these are people that would never buy a PS4, never buy an Xbox One. But they're buying a Switch. And they're probably the kind of people that might even take a chance on a game like this. So.
Yeah. There is a theory that came out of this as well. This is a direct Nintendo to Tencent deal. For this game to come out on Switch. This is the only non-mobile device this game is out for. Because this is a iOS Android thing. There have been versions of it released in Asia. specifically South Korea, Malaysia, other markets in which Tencent is active. This is not the spinoff though for those regions. This is Arena of Valor. There is speculation that this is Nintendo gearing themselves for a more full-throated entrance into the market. Possibly by the market, of course, I mean China. Mm-hmm. By 2019, which would be a first for the company. I mean, they were involved with the IQ company, but Nintendo themselves weren't releasing those things. IQ was releasing them because of all the weird Chinese ownership laws. This also goes hand in hand with the announcement a couple days ago that Breath of the Wild is getting an official Chinese translation patched into the game. Which was one of the more glaring omissions in terms of languages, but of course the only market that's Chinese as such that Nintendo has officially released the Switch in is Hong Kong. This is obviously a situation where, you know, Sony's active in that market now with the PS4. China isn't getting systems a whole generation behind like they used to. It used to be like the BRICS countries were getting the PS2 while we were deep in the PS3. BRICS being Brazil, India, Brazil, Russia, India, China. This sort of like developing countries that are, you know, have emerging markets and economies. But also have histories of piracy, so the companies aren't so eager to put their current stuff there. But that's all speculation still. What's interesting to me more than anything, though, is that this is the one that's coming in. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the MOBA that's coming in. It's not League. Mm-hmm. It's not, what's Blizzard's?
Heroes of the Storm.
So, yeah,
but those are both PC games, first and foremost.
They are.
So there wouldn't, this version of this type of genre, of this game genre, is perfect. It's already been, you know, it's in a way, it's already been made for Switch.
Right. It's not, but even things like Smite aren't PC focused ones, but they're
correct. Yeah, but they're definitely they're tweaked for console players and playing with a gamepad.
That's true.
Right. Like they have different perspectives. They're not pure.
Right. These are the touch first MOBA or something. What's interesting though is that Tencent is accused of, we'll say, a lack of creativity in some of their products, which is not the most unfair accusation.
Although and pretty common for large companies like Activision too.
Yeah, it's also pretty common in China.
Mm-hmm.
There is a cultural thing where copying isn't viewed as immoral. It's viewed as the way you learn stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at this game. Called King of Glory, as John said, or Strike Honor, of Kings, or Arena of Valor, depending on where you are.
Yeah, Honor of Kings. Yeah, it's had a couple.
Strike of Kings, King of Glory.
Yeah.
Yeah. It looks an awful lot like League in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But that's okay, because they own a big stake in Riot, as John pointed out.
Yep.
I can't tell if you guys are disgusted by Tencent's business, or if you're inspired.
No, it's business.
It's kind of, yeah. I'm kind of amazed by it. I don't know.
I think that's the right word. Like, I'm impressed by the growth that they've executed. There is a certain amount of just business as business that they execute in. And it's business in and of itself is morally neutral. It's how you leverage business as business that turns it from being a moral good or to a moral evil. They just kind of do. And, you know, we talked about a couple weeks ago when we were talking about the arcade classic archive potential for Donkey Kong, which is like, okay, well, how does Nintendo solve this? And my answer was, if you have enough money, the answer is just money. Tencent is sort of like the amalgamation of that. It's sort of like, this is the apex predator of, if you have enough money, there's no such thing as problems. Because if you run into a problem, you just buy the company.
Mm-hmm.
If Player Unknown Battlegrounds comes out and it's fucking gigantic in China, even though it's not officially released there, what do? You buy them.
Mm-hmm. Even now though it is, I think officially, they're actually, isn't Blue Hole a Chinese company?
Blue Hole's Korean.
Korean, okay.
So you are you just heavily invest in them and then you publish it in China. Mm-hmm. Tencent's gotten to the point though where they're publishing third party like big normal Western releases instead.
Yeah.
Of
Call of Duty Online.
Yeah. Or yep. I think they're doing some Activision stuff. I think they're doing some of Blizzard stuff too. Or at least they're involved. And Ubisoft. Like they're doing that stuff because A, releasing in China on your own is very difficult, if not impossible. And B, localizing for the Chinese market is involved and complicated. And guess what? Tencent could do both of those things. They have the money to make the problems go away. Mm-hmm. And they have the money to pay you to let them do your game for you.
Yeah. So, and they have the platforms to promote as well.
Yes. So you know? If Nintendo was going to make a deal to work with somebody to release the Switch in Asia, even if they want to do it themselves, you know, all the laws in China may complicate that matter. They might need a local partner who can make some of their challenges go away, and that there would be a lot worse partners than Tencent Holdings Limited. If this game does well, you will probably see more MOBAs or other kind of those games show up. One of the things I'm surprised is we haven't seen any of these rush of card games show up on Switch. Like, yeah. where the fuck is Hearthstone?
Yeah, seems like a natural fit.
There is a move towards these games that essentially the free to play with loot boxes, however you feel about those, and like MOBAs, card games, those kinds of games have a lot of those in them. That's their monetization model. Although I'm not sure what the monetization model of this one is. And there will be free to play games on Switch. The other two platforms have them. PC is replete with them. It's just a matter of time. But how this one performs will probably govern how many of those show up. And if this does well, we will probably see a flood of those. But I don't know what we're going to end up looking like here. I think the challenge is the Switch as a device is not always online because sometimes it's in your car. Mm-hmm. So like, how do they control that? How do they make it? Do they make offline modes for these games? How do they make that function? I mean, obviously, we talked about Phantasy Star is coming to Switch in Japan. That's a cloud-based game. So no, there's no offline mode. So you can do it, but we'll see. Are we surprised, though, that I'm not sure if I'm surprised or completely unfazed that this is the first one to show up.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a great choice.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, from a standpoint, but it's incredibly popular in places that aren't the West or Japan.
Didn't Microsoft help out with Smite or maybe just buy like the rights to their console exclusivity?
Maybe. Smite's weird, and it's a little bit of we're going back to our roguelike conversation. Like, it's a MOBA in its own way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, There's a somewhere in here. There's a path that leads to this game being the first on Switch. And I wonder if it's just like, hey, these are the markets where Tencent isn't super well known, and you know, Supercell is well known, and of course Riot's well known, but we as their corporate parent aren't well known. Here's a product on a platform that doesn't have any competition for this style of game that maybe we can sort of inject ourselves into these markets. I don't know. I don't know what the long-term strategy of this is, but to go back to the MOBA email, we're not the people who talk about MOBAs.
Well, yeah, but I think it does what both parties want to do. I think Nintendo would like to get a foothold into China, and I think Tencent wants to get a foothold into the North American console space, or at least get a higher profile than they've had in the past.
So, North America, Europe, and probably Japan.
Yeah, I think it works both ways, but I think also Tencent looks at it like, yeah, the games that we make, they're great for PC and they dominate on PC, but they're really not great for consoles. So I think this was kind of probably something they were trying to do for a while, and the Switch just happens to be the right device to them to do this.
Yeah, and it's had the right market reception, and it's doing well in various markets where they don't exist effectively. I mean, they exist, but they... They are here. You just don't know it.
Yeah, and I mean, in the past, you've seen a lot of hybrid devices like the Switch just fail outright. And
right.
And that was because you just don't have that Nintendo magic. Those games that bring people in and, you know, that will let people let people take a flyer on a hybrid console like the Switch. So
it's the same, it's almost the exact same conversation we had about the two id games.
Mm-hmm.
It's just from a completely different perspective. It'll be interesting to see what comes of this, and you know, maybe this is where one of us falls down a mobile hole and we never see them again.
Mm-hmm. I
hope
doubt
so.
It.
I hope it's. I kind of want Greg to become obsessed with becoming a hard carry in mobiles, in MOBAs.
I think it's going to be more Gee. He's going to be you know, Geet good. I think
he's going to Geet hard, good.
Hardcore.
Like I want Greg to very calmly explain that how you're supposed to be working the middle lane right now to somebody, but like clearly frustrated. You know when he gets frustrated with this, like every episode, and he kind of and like you can hear it, but he's also trying to, you know, project calmness.
Mm-hmm.
I want him to be talking to some first time MOBA player, and I don't know. We're gonna put them in Ontario since that's where we had two emails from earlier this time, at least from Canada. We'll put them in. I don't know, John, where are you from? We'll say that they're expats from that part, from wherever John happens to live. Maybe they live in the California area now. And he's just very calmly explaining the role of a hard carry to them. John, I expect you to perform correctly.
Yeah. We had to go around all of Canada and then California.
Yeah.
To just make that joke.
Maybe a stop in Atlanta and Boston while they're at it.
I'll see. Like I'll just, see how many times I say the phrase "hard carry" to people before I get slapped.
I'm gonna say immediately.
Do we have another email?
We're gonna call it there. We're gonna call it on that. We're gonna call it on conversation about hard carries.
Oh, thank God!
Yes.
Thank God. What the world always wanted. All right. So before we wrap up. Alex.
Yes.
Thank you. I was worried for a second there. Thank you for joining us. Where can people hear you?
You can hear me on Say Whatever Podcast. I actually host it, and that's available on any podcast service.
All of them. All right, so just search for Say Whatever Podcast, and you will find it.
Yeah. Thank you guys
you know,
so
know
much
that.
For having me on here tonight.
Thank you for joining us. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
And you know how I know you can find it by just searching? Because I just did. And it was there. It's amazing. God. SEO, everybody. So, Greg, what's our music to end the show this week? Oh no, he's not here. But you know what? Greg is a professional. He's an anointed us professional, and he sent us the music this week. And the music
Did he send us Joanna Dark? To tell us what the music is, or that's what I was hoping for.
Just continue. I can't even do it without laughing.
Are you sure, Sean? You sure you can't do it, Mr. Connery? Sir
Joanna.
Connery? It's like
you, the movie. I can't even do it. Forget it.
It's like he's in the room with us. All mm-hmm. right. So, music selection for tonight. Is the Nimbus Land theme from Super Mario RPG. He's inspired by the launch of the SNES Classic, plus the Mario and Luigi remake coming next week calls for Yoko Shimomura RPG music goodness. And on that, it is time to go. Thank you for listening, and thank you guys for being here today. Goodbye.
Bye.
Later.
Later, Joanna.